You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferrack.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up on Wisconsin Life, we'll talk to an actor about the improv comedy scene in Wisconsin.
First, the election came to an end with President-elect Donald Trump's win almost 2 weeks ago, but the dust is still far from settled. The divisive race between Trump and Clinton didn't just make the split between Democrats and Republicans more obvious, it revealed some fault lines within each party.
Before Wisconsin went for Trump, it voted for Ted Cruz in the Republican primary. It was also home to conservatives who align themselves with the Never Trump movement. And one of the most influential people who voiced their concerns about Trump is a longtime conservative host of the talk show Midday with Charlie Sykes on WTMJ in Milwaukee.
Now, with Trump as the president-elect, the question remains, what's the path forward for conservatives who opposed him? Charlie Sykes joins us now. Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us on the show today.
Good afternoon.
You told our colleagues at NPR's Morning Edition, the loneliest person in America is the anti-Trump Republican today because we're out here in the wilderness. How does it feel being where you are right now?
Well, I knew that conservatives were going to be in the wilderness after this election one way or another. I didn't realize it was going to be a small desert island. It sort of feels that way. But, of course, we're still trying to get some idea of where we're going and what this administration is going to look like. And even now, nobody really knows.
So you opposed the Trump campaign during the primaries. You were one of the conservatives who continued to oppose Donald Trump even after he was the nominee. What is it that worries you about President Donald Trump?
Well, you know, less the ideology than the character and the temperament of the man. The fact that he is thin-skinned, vindictive, and erratic. All things that ought to be a little bit concerning for somebody who now has their finger on the nuclear button or conceivably could. So I think a lot of it was the question of his fitness for office. And, you know, that's what makes the question of who he surrounds himself with and what agenda he adopts so absolutely critical. Usually at this point, we have some idea of what a presidency is going to look like or some notion of the way the man in the Oval Office is going to handle the duties. With Donald Trump, just no idea. Absolutely no idea.
You mentioned the people he surrounds himself with. We're starting to see some of those names, two of them in key advisory roles. Reince Priebus from Wisconsin, Steve Bannon from Breitbart News. What do you make of those two?
Yeah, very much polar opposites. And in fact, I think that the relationship rivalry between Reince Priebus and Steve Bannon is largely going to shape what kind of an administration there's going to be. Reince Priebus is somebody that I know well, that we know well here in Wisconsin, very much a mainstream figure, somebody who I think is going to try to have, you know, all of the various parties work together. But Steve Bannon, you know, represents something genuinely disturbing. And this is one of the reasons why I was never Trump. This association with what's known as the alt-right, which is has close ties to white nationalism, white supremacy, some of the darker aspects of the right, and that decision to put Steve Bannon that close to the president of the United States, you know, ought to be and is, I think, legitimately concerning.
Let's give a listen to Paul Ryan talking to reporters, and this is after the election campaign where there was a rocky relationship between Paul Ryan and Donald Trump. Here's Paul Ryan post-election.
Welcome to the dawn of a new unified Republican government. Feels really good to say that, actually. This will be a government focused on turning President-elect Trump's victory into real progress for the American people. Our team is very excited, and we cannot wait to get to work. At the same time, the task ahead of us is enormous. If we're going to put our country back on the right track, we have got to be bold and we have to go big.
So Paul Ryan, Scott Walker, another prominent Wisconsin Republican who had been opposed to Trump, called on other candidates to unite against Donald Trump for the future, the sake of the future of the party. What do you worry about when it comes to Wisconsin Republicans you've supported in the past making this compromise?
Well, you know, I mean, that may turn out to be the triumph of hope over experience. But again, you know, Wisconsin Republicans have represented, I think, a very different style of conservatism than Donald Trump has represented. But they're going to play a very significant role in this campaign. And I think this is one of the most important jobs that Reince Priebus has got, which is to find a way to keep that relationship between Paul Ryan on track. You have, you know, Reince Priebus, who's one of Paul Ryan's closest friends and allies. And then you have Steve Bannon, we talked about just a moment ago, who has made it clear that it was his mission at one time to destroy Paul Ryan. So you're going to have this balancing act going on inside the White House. know, I think that to the extent that the Trump administration can be successful, he's going to have to realize that he's going to have to work with the Congress of the United States, something that he may understand theoretically, but I'm not sure that he fully grasps what that means.
Talking to radio host, longtime radio host Charlie Sykes, a leader in the informal Never Trump movement through their primary campaign. Charlie, you've been kind of diagnosing what happened that put Donald Trump at the head of the ticket here for the Republican Party. You blame yourself a little. You blame high-stakes politics. You blame Democrats and Republicans. Talk about what happened that put Donald Trump there.
Yeah, well, you mentioned that I was influential, apparently not influential enough here. I think there's a lot of things that happen, and I am going to try to figure this out. You know, I think it's a matter of, you know, on the part of conservatives and Republicans, perhaps, you know, a lack of courage, a lack of principle, the fact that they were not able to coalesce a crowded field to be able to block a candidate like Donald Trump. I think the Democrats, unfortunately, did not understand what they were up against. I think that they believed that somehow, rather than presenting a message of their own that was, in fact, inspirational, that was inclusive, they thought that because Donald Trump was just so awful, suddenly, you know, somehow that was all they needed to point out. So I think a lot of people have underestimated Donald Trump throughout this campaign, and people who I think should have stood up and said, no, this is not what we believe in, this is not what we want, were reluctant to do that. So I think there's surprise on both sides of the aisle and culpability.
What are you hoping for from Republicans? Republicans control, obviously, both houses of Congress and the White House under Donald Trump. What are you hoping for Republicans to, I guess, stop what you're worried most about from Donald Trump?
Well, first of all, you know, I was wrong about Donald Trump's electability, and I hope that he proves me wrong about what kind of a president he's going to be. I mean, I will support him when I think that he's right. I'm going to push him in the direction where I, you know, think that he should go, and then I'm going to call him out and criticize him, you know, when he's wrong. I hope that the Congress follows through on their promises. I hope they pass some legislation that will restart the economy. I really hope that they figure out a way to put people back to work. You know, I hope that there is some sort of reasonable compromise, you know, some sort of reasonable comprehensive tax reform. There's a lot of things that they can do, rolling back some of the abuses from the Obama administration. But I also really hope that they hold this president accountable. I hope they hold him accountable to the constitutional norms, to the political norms. I hope they take seriously some of these ethical issues. I hope they don't feel the need to simply defend and enable and rationalize everything this president does. And that's, of course, the danger, that conservatives now find themselves with all of these things, these possibilities before them. But this is a cancer at the heart of all of this. But does that mean that they have to ally themselves with the alt-right? Does it mean they have to turn a blind eye to all of that, you know, that sort of an ideology, because that price may be too high. And conservatives also need to, Republicans, before they get too giddy about this, need to remember that the face of their party remains one of the most unpopular politicians in America. A lot of people voted for him because he wasn't Hillary Clinton, and that it was short of a mandate. So I'm hoping that they understand that their association with Donald Trump should not be one of servility and agreement and rationalization of everything that he does.
Briefly, as we wrap up, Charlie, you're leaving your radio show. You wear other hats at the Wisconsin Policy Research Institute, Right Wisconsin. You're an author. What else is next for you after you're off the air?
Well, you know, we'll see. I've got about 18 more shows to go. I'm going to sit down. I'm going to write a book, which has the tentative working title, How the Right Lost Its Mind. And then I'm going to, you know, go from there and see what, looking back, try to figure out what just happened to us.
We'll leave it there. Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Charlie Sykes. He's the longtime radio host of Midday with Charlie Sykes on WTMJ in Milwaukee. You heard there about 18 more shows before he's done with that. He was also a leading voice of the Never Trump movement in Wisconsin. He joined us to talk about what the future looks like to conservatives who opposed the president-elect.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, our guest tells us how the new presidential administration can learn from the failures of past presidents. And by the way, if you're looking for some radio listening on Thursday, Thanksgiving Thursday. We will be with you all day long here on the Ideas Network. Perhaps most helpfully, the Splendid Tables Turkey Confidential special. Tune into the Ideas Network at 10 on Thanksgiving Day for the Splendid Table. Some of the brightest stars in the culinary world will answer your calls live and help listeners navigate the biggest cooking day of the year. So you can get live help desk cooking advice with Turkey Confidential, Thanksgiving Day at 10 on the Ideas Network.
Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's executive producer Erica Janik.
Horan Riley always wanted to be an actor. He found a way to live his dream as part of Encore Studios, a theater company for people with disabilities. Riley spoke to me using one of his favorite voices on his communication device.
I began acting when I was 18 years old, when I was still in high school. Although I don't remember the play, but I do remember I loved it.
When I first met you, which is now 16 years ago, I believe you mentioned that you always wanted to be an actor.
That's Kelsey Shaneauer, the founder and executive and artistic director of Encore Studios in Madison. Encore is the only professional theater company for people with disabilities in Wisconsin.
I've always loved movies, and I wanted to tell stories. Acting was the best way I could think of.
So that's always been a big part of your life and always a big desire. And so when you came to us, you know, we were thrilled to welcome you. And there's a lot of just great innate ability and a really amazing presence. I think your first role, the first full-scale production that you were in, you made the front page of the Wisconsin State Journal. So I know I didn't in the first thing I've done. When was that? That was 2001. That was To Love or Not to Love.
Corin is a Madison native. He joined Encore 16 years ago.
My favorite part of acting is to be able to perform for people I care about.
He's since acted in more than 40 productions in all kinds of roles.
We do 3 plays locally, and those plays are all original full-scale productions.
My favorite role was playing the character Colin in the play Real Life. I was lucky enough to be able to perform with my friend John Meister.
Real Life was something that I did write for, kind of for myself and for the other actors, and it is focusing on high-functioning autism, and it gives a very interesting, varied perspective on that really important issue that's becoming much more in the forefront these days.
How does he get in the head of his characters?
Rehearse, 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 and then rehearse some more.
There's still a number of roles on his bucket list.
Romantic scenes are my favorite. However, I don't get to play them very often. I would love to play the role of the wolf in Stephen Sondheim's musical, Into the Woods. I like playing mean characters. It's a lot of fun.
Corin Riley is an actor in Madison. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and Wisconsin Public Television in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life on our website, wisconsinlife.org, and on Facebook. I'm Erica Janik.
From local theater, we turn to the improv comedy scene in Wisconsin. A while back, Rob Ferret spoke with Jason Stevens. He's a voice actor and co-founder of Monkey Business Institute, an improv comedy troupe in Madison.
Jason, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you very much for having me.
What drew you to the improv side of the comedy scene?
Honestly, I went to a show one night when Madison was home to a comedy sports franchise, and I saw the folks on stage doing what I had been doing since I was a little boy. I didn't know that that was something that you could just do. So I was drawn to the unscripted nature of it, the idea that anything could happen as long as you were on stage with people who believed whatever you believed. And there were no mistakes. There were mistakes, but there weren't errors. You know, you could get away with just about anything doing improv.
Now, we've seen improv rise and fall over the years on TV.
Sure.
So can you just explain, basically, for maybe someone who's never seen improv, what is it? How does it work?
So there are different types of improvisational comedy, and there's different types of improvisation outside of comedy. For the general public's perception of improv, you'd look at Whose Line Is It Anyway, probably the most popular short-form arrangement of improv, and the audience plays a part. They give suggestions. They give ideas. That's more to ensure that the improvisers are making it up on the spot. Mm-hmm. But sometimes it also adds an element that entertains the improvisers. And then those improvisers either perform short scenes, create short character pieces, or play games inspired by those suggestions.
Now, you've done a little stand-up. You've done a lot of improv.
Yes.
I think of myself as kind of a funny person who would be terrible at both. But it seems like stand-up would be nerve-wracking. It's just you. It's all you. Is there something about safety in numbers with improv?
Each of them have their fear factor built in. With improv, the safety is that the moment you've said what you're going to say or do what you've done, it's gone. It's in the air, and now you move on to something else. So if you hit a sour note doing improv, if you do something that the audience doesn't appreciate or doesn't get, you move on to the next thing. With stand-up, you're honing your material over night after night after night of doing it. So there's terror in that for me, having to rely on my own wit and then script it and then wait for the laugh. It's all in the timing, and there's a perception to it. I'd much rather fly by the seat of my pants.
Okay, so how would it work? Say you and I were an improv troupe.
Sure.
What would a thing... So, and we'd ask, what, for a suggestion from Michelle over there?
Yes, we'd say, Michelle, can you please give us a relationship that you might... two people might have together.
So say it out loud.
Divorce.
Okay.
So the way I do to handle a suggestion is often to let that suggestion influence or inspire me. Uh-huh. So when I think of divorce, we don't necessarily have to do a scene that's a divorcing couple or at a therapist's office. We can let divorce inspire us. When I think of divorce, I think about two people doing the best they can to get along. Mm-hmm. And so maybe that's our scene. So we'd go into it wherever we happen to be. That's a really nice hat you're wearing.
Mm-hmm. I'd have to say something like, oh, thank you. I got it at the store down the street.
Oh, you shop down there.
Well, what's wrong with down there?
Oh, nothing. Nothing's
wrong
with...
Well, wait. You judged that.
Did I?
Hmm? You had that look. You know the look.
What look?
You know. Like when I say
again.
I like mixed martial arts. That look.
That's a horrible hat. I take it back. Everything I said.
Okay, so that's improv, and we've demonstrated my shortcomings on improv. But as I understand it, the key is yes and. You take the thing the other person said.
Yes.
You never shoot it down.
Correct. You let that influence you. You let that flavor you. And, you know, a lot of people will say different things about improv, how it's a character piece. You know, improv is all about characters. Mm-hmm. It's all about story. And that's really true, because even in a short form improv setting, you'll have some games that really don't rely much on character. Mm-hmm. And that's really accessible, and it's really fun to watch. But I think you also need those fun stories. Mm-hmm. In improv,
what is it? What's the main skill that it takes to be good at improv and to be a real contributor to make that spontaneous scene really funny?
Being present.
Okay.
Without question, being present and being able to listen and enjoy what's going on in front of you, seeing your scene partners and hearing them. And luckily that translates really well into a lot of different things.
So the key, it sounds like, oh, you can't be like, this was funny when I did it yesterday, so I'm going to do that again today.
Exactly. And you can't...
It's the opposite of stand-up.
Yeah, and you can't go into it with an idea that, you know, I have this thought in my head, you are a butcher and I'm a farmer and I'm going to sell you this pig. Because when I walk on stage, you're going to maybe tell me who I am or infer who you are. So you can't go into it with an idea. You have to let that happen.
Well, I'm going to shift gears to a bit of your comedic life.
Sure.
Away from improv, you do... And get work doing impersonations.
Yes, I do. I do a variety of celebrity impersonations. For instance, I'm well known for my Morgan Freeman impersonation. I don't know when it was that I found I could impersonate Morgan Freeman.
Yeah, how do you stumble onto that?
I think it just happened. One day I was talking and thought, oh, that sounds like Morgan Freeman. So I do a lot of natural voice work, but part of the flexibility that I've got is to do the impersonations.
And you've done Morgan, you're big in Australia as Morgan Freeman, I understand.
Australia and New Zealand. I even get work in other countries as the president, Barack Obama. And, you know, that's unusual to me because when you think about other countries, I'm a rock star there. You know, how does that work?
And you do a Christopher Walken to a more commonly done impersonation.
Yeah, yeah. Look, everybody does a Christopher Walken impression. It's commonplace, mostly, but it comes in handy.
It comes in handy. All right. Well, so if somebody, just getting back to improv for a moment, if somebody wanted to give it a try yes. around the state, I know you're here in Madison, there's mm-hmm. other improv groups around the state.
Yeah.
How do they do it? How do you make your first step?
Well, first of all, go to see an improv show, because especially in Madison where you've got multiple improv groups that are all vying to entertain you, it's helpful to see what everyone offers, and it's helpful to meet the people who improvise and get to know them. And then from there, take a class. And then, take another class if you like it.
All right. And so you can do that in a safe space. You don't have to start right off in front of a crowd.
Absolutely. Classes, improv classes, are safe places where you are encouraged to take chances and fail.
Well, Jason, thanks a lot. It's been a lot of fun.
Thank you very much.
That was Jason Stevens, voice actor and co-founder of Monkey Business Institute in Madison. We've been talking about the improv comedy scene in Wisconsin.
Coming up, the author of the book Why Presidents Fail shares advice for the incoming administration on how not to fail. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farrow.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Reveal. This week, Reveal goes back to the Spotlight Legacy, a groundbreaking newspaper investigation into abuse by Catholic priests that led to the exposure of crimes around the world. That's tonight after 7 on the Ideas Network.
First, we continue our occasional series on presidential leadership advice. Last Thursday, we heard from a Wisconsin expert on servant leadership.
Our next guest says presidents should learn from the failures of past administrations to learn how to avoid failure themselves. We talked to her about her book on presidential failures a while back, and now she joins us with her thoughts on the incoming Trump administration.
Elaine Kmark is with us. She is a senior fellow in the Governance Studies Program at the Brookings Institution and the director of the Center for Effective Public Management at Brookings. Her most recent book is Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again. Elaine, welcome back to the show.
Well, thank you for having me again.
You tweeted 2 weeks before the election, Elaine, so we didn't know who was going to win at that point. Quoting here, the next president needs to spend more time governing, less time talking. What did you mean by that?
Well, what I mean by that is that when you look at the really big failures presidents have had, the kind of failures that are not unique to one party or another, the kind of failures where everybody, whether they're of the president's party or opposed to the president, agree on the fact that, that's a basic screw-up. Those kinds of failures are due to governmental failure. And presidents get the blame for it, and their political power is decreased. Sometimes they lose election, depending on when it happens in their term. And presidents need to pay attention to the implementation of their policies. Whereas modern presidents have spent an awful lot of time and still do talking, traveling, giving speeches, and they need to sit back a little bit and make sure that what they want to get done happens properly.
Well, now let's talk about Donald Trump. Now, we do know who won that election. From what you've seen of him as a business person, as a campaigner, do you feel like he can step away from that communication role and really focus on the details of implementation?
Well, it's interesting because I think that may be his fatal flaw, is that he is addicted to talking and promoting and not addicted to actually implementing. In his business dealings, he was all PR and all branding, and other people actually did the building and the, you know, actually making the buildings happen. So if he brings that into the White House, he could be in trouble. Now, there's a way it may work out that Mike Pence is actually the person who worries about the details of government and getting it done. But Donald Trump doesn't seem to have the inclination for the details of policy and government that would keep him from getting into the kinds of big failures that previous presidents have had.
Now, presidents have come from different backgrounds. Some have been governors of states like Mike Pence with some experience in management like that. Some from the Congress and elsewhere. Now one from the business world. Can a president make up maybe for some of those shortcomings by appointing good managers, good detail people around them?
Sometimes they can. The problem is that what our recent presidents have tended to do is that the people closest to them during the campaign remain close to them when they're in the government. So what that means is a campaign's put a premium on talking, showmanship, branding, all of those things that become a lot less important when you're actually an incumbent and people blame you for outcomes. So if you bring the same people in who are good at doing those things and who helped you win, generally they're not very good at implementing policy and making the government work in the way you want it to work.
Talking to Elaine Kmark, author of Why Presidents Fail. She's sharing some thoughts on the incoming Trump administration, saying we can learn from the failures of past administrations of both parties to make an administration more successful. You recently wrote a piece post-election, Elaine, what Donald Trump should know about Washington. And you talk about the role of the often vilified federal bureaucracy and the civil servants there. What should Donald Trump know about them?
Well, the first thing he should know is he can't fire them, okay? He can't go into offices and say, you're fired. They are protected by the civil service law. And while we like to dump on civil servants, the fact of the matter is that show me a country that doesn't have a professional civil service, and I'll show you a place where you don't want to live. So they're people we like to hate, but we do need. Secondly, is that if the president of the United States walks into an agency, everybody would be very excited and have lots of selfies with him, et cetera. But he can't tell them to do something that's against the law. In other words, he has to change the laws in order to change what the vast majority of civil servants do, because they're not out there operating in a vacuum. They're operating according to laws that are on the books. Now, it's, you know, obviously, Donald Trump thinks we should change a lot of those laws. Frankly, I think there's a lot that could be changed, too. But you have to do that first. You cannot. This is not like the private sector where a new CEO takes over and says, we're going to do this now, not that. It's, in fact, quite different because you are the people who work for you are bound by the law.
One thing that's kind of unique about Donald Trump coming from the business world, there have been a lot of stories over the last couple of days about potential conflicts of interest. If he's doing business in another country, how does he manage that? How does he separate himself from his president self, I guess, from his business owner self? Issues of transparency there. What would be your advice along those lines?
This is nothing but trouble for him. He and his family have to get out of their business dealings. They have to be very far apart from their business dealings. This will be nothing but trouble. He criticized Hillary Clinton a great deal during the campaign for using her position as Secretary of State to help the Clinton Foundation. And I'm not commenting on whether that was true or not. I actually don't think it was. But frankly, frankly, the Clinton Foundation was a charitable organization that actually gave away a lot of money. If he's in the White House and there is the perception that he is using the government or using his position to help his family for-profit business, this is just not going to work. I can see even constitutional issues arising from it. There's an obscure part of the Constitution called the emoluments provision that says that a president can't use his ability of foreign affairs to enrich himself. So this is a total disaster, and they really ought to clean this up fast.
We're talking to Elaine Kmark from the Brookings Institution. She's the author of Why Presidents Fail. She is sharing advice for the incoming Trump administration on how to learn from the mistakes of the past and not fail.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you think Donald Trump will be an effective manager of the federal government? Do you see him getting competent advisors who will help him run things smoothly and effectively? How do you see possible changes to things like the Affordable Care Act, immigrant enforcement, NAFTA, and other government policies shaping up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll pick up the conversation, maybe hear from you, coming up on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard, and we're continuing our conversation with Elaine Kmark, author of Why Presidents Fail. She says a new administration should learn lessons from past presidential failures, and she says step one is talking less, managing more.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you have confidence in Donald Trump to be an effective manager of the federal government? What questions do you have for our guest about presidential leadership? What are your hopes and fears for Donald Trump as president of the United States? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Central Time Facebook page. Elaine, I want to get into some specific policy areas to talk about maybe some of the complexity of doing things that may be simple to say out loud, like repeal and replace Obamacare. What would be involved in something as really complex as that?
Well, first of all, it's the law of the land. So they will have to send legislation to Congress, basically repealing it. Once they do that, the members of Congress and the public will realize that there are pieces of Obamacare that everybody likes, like the fact that insurance companies can no longer reject you for a pre-existing medical condition. Okay, so what will happen is that's probably the most popular part of Obamacare. What will happen is members of Congress, spurred on by people at home, will say, oh, well, let's keep that one. Well, once you keep that one, then you have another problem, which is the insurance companies say, hey, wait a minute. We're already having trouble with people who are very sick at being the only people buying insurance. And of course, if you have only sick people buying health insurance, it's kind of like having only people with DUIs buying auto insurance, right? I mean, the market just doesn't work. And so down the road, there's a problem with that one. So before you know it, you're in trouble. I like to quote President Clinton, who gave a talk here at Brookings not too long ago, and he said, you know, they pay us, presidents, to look down the road and around the corner. And this business of looking around the corner on policy and policy change is really a tricky one. Many experienced politicians who've become presidents get all twisted up in this. And so now we have someone who's never done politics going to try and do some pretty complicated things.
Right. And we saw with the rollout of the Affordable Care Act some serious bumps in the road, especially that whole website implementation. One of the problems you wrote about in your book, will we see similar problems, however Congress decides to tackle this, in how the administration would have to implement those changes?
Yeah, we certainly will. I mean, the big problems are going to come with the cessation of the subsidies. Okay, what happens to people who are already in Obamacare if Congress pulls back the subsidies for their health insurance programs? Are they grandfathered? Is this eased out? Are they suddenly dumped from one year to the next? Is there a transition provision written into the repeal law. This is kind of a complicated business, and we're now it's affecting millions of people who have Obamacare. So you can get even if there is the political will, which I think there is, to try and substantially change and repeal Obamacare. Unwinding an existing program that millions of people are participating in is no simple matter, either logistically or politically.
Let's bring in a caller now at 800-642-1234 with Willem in Colfax. Willem, hi.
Hi. I don't think he can be successful just by the example that he's already led. So many very radical people that he's surrounding himself with. I give an example of this General Flynn, who is called a Muslim of the Islamic faith, that it's a radical political ideology, that it's not a real religion. There are 1 billion Muslims in the world. Many of them live in the United States. The First Amendment of our Constitution says that we have the right to practice our religion, and it's one of the Abrahamic religions. I think to insult that many people in the world puts our country at risk. I think it's a disqualifying statement.
Well, thanks. I want to get our guest in and maybe get another caller or two as well. Elaine, what do you make of the picks you've seen? As you mentioned, presidents often pick loyal campaign people. That Donald Trump so far appears to be no exception.
Well, I mean, look, reality will hit Mr. Allen and Mr. Trump at the same time. There are many ways in which we cooperate with the Islamic world. We cooperate with countries in the Middle East. A lot of times that cooperation actually helps us avoid terrorist attacks. Similarly, we cooperate, and if we respect the Muslim community here in the United States, there are plots uncovered on a regular basis. Some of them we hear about, some of them we don't. So what the flip side of their sort of hardline approach is that, ironically, it's by being respectful of these nations and this religion that we actually can protect ourselves because, frankly, not all Muslims are terrorists. That's kind of ridiculous.
Well, thanks for that call. Go next to Todd in Menominee Falls. Todd, hi.
Hello.
What do you think?
I think Donald Trump is a powerful individual, and like Kellyanne McCormick said when she managed him, you can't make him conform to the standard. She had to go with the non-conventional, and you can't count Donald Trump out. I think he'll be a powerful president for this country, and I think it'll be exciting to see what he does, and maybe he will do some wonderful things.
Todd? I know that a lot of thanks for the call. I want to get Elaine Kamark in this before we run out of time. Maybe we've underestimated Donald Trump through the campaign. Maybe something about his personality, his management, will end up paying off.
Well, it's entirely possible. He is a powerful person, and he is quite skilled at communicating with the public, etc. The problem a candidate like Trump has, and a lot of presidents have had, I mean, I write about Obama, I write about Bush, I write about Jimmy Carter, is that when you are president, reality takes over. And you, at some point, you are called upon to deliver the goods. And if all you are doing is talking and not paying attention to implementation, then after a while, the voters kind of get sick of you and they ask, what have you done for me lately? So let's just have an example out there. A year from now, will there be more illegal immigrants deported in 2017 than there were under President Obama in 2016 or 2015. Okay, obviously that's a metric that we can apply to President Trump. I think if he figures out a way to implement his harder line policy, there should be, right? Those numbers should go up. But if he runs up against a series of laws he can't change, or if he discovers that, gee, we already have been deporting a great number of illegal immigrants, his supporters may feel a little bit different. They may feel, oh, he sold us a bill of goods. So this remains to be seen.
We'll leave it there for now. Elaine, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Well, thank you for having me.
We've been talking to Elaine Kamark, director of the Center for Effective Public Management at the Brookings Institution, author of Why Presidents Fail and How They Can Succeed Again.
Driving is something police do every day. It's also one of the most dangerous things they do. According to the Officer Down Memorial page, a handful of officers are killed each year in vehicle pursuits. In an ongoing series, WPR News is following a class of police recruits as they go through the Madison Training Academy.
Reporter Bridget Bowden traveled with the recruits to Fort McCoy, where they learned emergency driving skills.
At the State Patrol Academy at Fort McCoy, recruit Stephanie Nelson is sitting in a squad car. She's about to drive through a maze of cones, performing an advanced evasive maneuver. She radios her supervisor.
Nelson, advanced evasive.
Go.
And starts to accelerate.
All right.
At the last second, an arrow tells her which way to turn. She jerks the wheel left. Then right. And she makes it through without hitting any cones. In this course, the recruits learn the mechanics of emergency driving, like how to quickly and safely make sharp turns. But for Nelson, the hardest part is getting out of her own head.
Calm. You need to stay calm. And if you listen to that voice in your head that's telling you you're doing everything wrong, then you're going to continue to do things wrong.
And Sergeant Daryl Doberstein, emergency vehicle operations trainer, agrees. He says they intentionally build up stress during training. That way, recruits will be able to perform if they're ever in a stressful driving situation, like a high-speed pursuit.
Because people in stressful situations, if they can remain a little calmer, and we try to run them through repetitions on that, the more calm they can remain, the better they'll perform when reality is in front of them.
The MPD adopted a new pursuit policy in October. It's stricter than the old policy and requires the danger of the pursuit itself to be considered before and during the chase. If the pursuit becomes too dangerous, it must be terminated. Sergeant Doberstein was on the committee that made the changes.
One of the things we looked at is how many pursuits were we pursuing people that the dangerousness of their crime exceeded the dangerousness of being in a high-speed pursuit.
In the last 5 years, the MPD has been involved in just over 100 pursuits. Doberstein says he thinks that will change.
We will be in less pursuits that, quite frankly, we probably didn't need to be in the first place.
At Fort McCoy, the recruits also practice traffic stops. Trainers drive cars around the track. Then recruits have to spot violations, pull the car over, and write tickets. Nelson pulls her training sergeant over for rolling through a stop sign.
Hello.
Hello.
Hi, I'm Stephanie Nelson with the Madison Police Department.
Hi, Officer Nelson.
Hi. Do you know why I pulled you over today?
I don't. I thought you were going to lie.
After each traffic stop, they debrief on what went right and what went wrong. Officer Bob Beach is one of the trainers. He says the skills the recruits learn here will be some of their most used skills once they hit the streets.
Every day they're going to be driving a squad car. Many days they're going to have to drive in an emergency mode to get to a call where someone's asking for help. And a lot of what we do are traffic stops.
And he says even though traffic stops are fairly routine for officers, they still present some danger.
The car we've stopped, we don't know anything about these people yet in most cases. So we don't know, that's an unknown. But then we have all the other traffic around us. People that see a police car on the side of the road may pay less attention to what they're doing. So we have to be concerned about other traffic around us.
Overall, the top priority, he says, is safety. In our next installment, we'll take a look at how entering the police force impacts the recruits' family lives. Bridget Bowden, Wisconsin Public Radio.
For other installments in WPR's Police Academy series, visit wpr.org/policeacademy.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.